I tried to pull my foot out straight with my hands, but started to pass out with the pain. So Kate called our neighbours, who put me on the back seat of their car and took me to A&E at my own hospital. A wheelchair was found, and soon I was in a short queue at the reception desk, manned by two fierce-looking women, behind what looked like bulletproof glass. I sat there, patiently, gritting my teeth, my broken leg sticking out in front of me. After a short delay, I was facing one of the receptionists. "Name?" she asked. "Henry Marsh. Date of birth? 5350. Actually, I'm the senior consultant neurosurgeon at this hospital. Religion?" she asked in reply, without batting an eyelid. "None," I replied, crestfallen, but thinking that at least my hospital was truly egalitarian. The interrogation went on for a short time, and I was then rescued by one of the casualty sisters, who promptly established that my foot was dislocated and that it needed reducing. I was very gratified at how quickly this was done, and painlessly at that, thanks to IV morphine and midazolam and Entonox. My last memory, before the drugs rendered me unaware of everything around me, is of my trying to persuade the enthusiastic sister not to take an enormous pair of scissors to my brand-new green corduroy trousers. When I started to come round in a happy haze from the drugs and reflected on what it would have been like to have had a fracture like mine reduced in the past without any anaesthetic at all, I found my orthopaedic colleague standing at the end of my trolley. I had called him on my mobile from the back seat of my neighbour's car on the way to A&E. "It's a fracture dislocation," he said. "They've reduced it nicely, but it will need an operation, internal fixation. I could do that tomorrow at the private hospital." "I've got insurance," I said. "Yes, let's do that." "We'll have to get a private ambulance," said the sister. "Don't worry," said my colleague, "I can take him myself." So I was wheeled out of A&E, my left leg in a long plaster back slab, and helped into my colleague's red Mercedes sports car. Thus I was taken in some style to the private hospital 3 miles away, where the fracture was duly fixed the next day. My colleague insisted on keeping me in hospital for 5 days, on the grounds that I was a doctor and would not listen to his medical advice that I should rest my leg for the first few days after surgery. So I spent much of the following week in bed, with my leg propped up in the air, looking at a rather fine oak tree outside the window of my room, reading P.G. Woodhouse, and reflecting on the way in which many of the government's so-called market-driven reforms of the NHS seem to be driving the NHS even further away from what went on in the real market of the private sector, in which I was once again a patient. I could occasionally hear my colleagues going to visit their patients in the rooms next to mine, their voices full of charm and polite encouragement. On the morning of my discharge, I went down to the outpatient area to wait to have the plaster changed. I watched the many outpatients coming and going. My colleagues in smart dark suits would emerge from time to time from their consulting rooms to bring in the next patient waiting to see them. Some of them knew me and looked somewhat startled to see me disguised as a patient in a dressing gown with a leg in plaster. Most of them stopped and commiserated and laughed with me at my bad luck. One of them, a particularly pompous physician, stopped for a moment and looked surprised. "Fracture dislocation of the left ankle," I said. "Oh, dear," he said in a very prim voice, as though he disapproved of the vulgar way in which, by allowing my leg to be broken, I had become a mere patient, and he quickly returned to his room. I was summoned to the plaster room, where my orthopaedic colleague removed the old dressing and carefully studied the two incisions, one on either side of my ankle. He declared himself happy and then, taking my leg in his hands, redressed the wounds and placed a new plaster back slab against my foot and leg, holding it in place with a crepe bandage. I thought rather wistfully of the huge gulf that separates this sort of medicine from what I practice as a neurosurgeon. "I rarely touch my patients, you know," I said to him, "other than when operating on them, of course. It's all just the history and the brain scan and long, depressing conversations. Not at all like this. This is rather nice." "Yes, neurosurgery is all doom and gloom. But our occasional triumphs are all the greater as a result," I started to say before he interrupted my philosophizing. "You've got to keep that foot up for the next few weeks, 95% of the time, because it's going to become very swollen." I bade him goodbye and, picking up my crutches, hopped out of the room. A few weeks later, I suffered a vitreous hemorrhage and retinal tear in my other eye, but it was easier to fix than the left eye had been. I was back at work within a matter of days. I had been lucky compared to my patients, and I was full of the profound and slightly irrational gratitude for my colleagues that all patients have for their doctors when things go well. Chapter 22. Astrocytoma. Noun. A brain tumour derived from non-nervous cells. All grades of malignancy occur. After the success of the trigeminal neuralgia operation, Igor was keen that when I next went out to Ukraine, I should operate on a number of patients with especially challenging brain tumours, which he assured me could not be treated safely in Ukraine by his senior colleagues. I did not share his enthusiasm and told him so. But when I arrived on my next visit, there was a long queue of patients with quite dreadful brain tumours waiting to see me in the dingy corridor outside his office. The outpatient clinics I have conducted over the years in Igor's office have always been bizarre events, and quite unlike anything else I have ever done. As Igor's fame grew, patients would come from all over Ukraine to consult him. There was no appointment system. Patients would turn up at any time and seem to accept that this might involve waiting all day to be seen. On the occasion of my visits, the queue of patients would stretch all the way down the long hospital corridor outside his office and disappear from view around a distant corner. We would start at 8 in the morning and continue until late in the evening without a break. There would often be several patients and their families in the small office all at once, some of them dressed, some of them undressed. There might also be journalists and TV crews conducting interviews, especially when Igor's political situation was proving problematical. There were three telephones in the room, and most of them were in constant use. There were rarely fewer than 7 or 8 people in the room at the same time. I found all this chaos exhausting and irritating, and at first I blamed Igor for it, telling him that he should institute an appointment system. But he said that in Ukraine nobody would adhere to it, and that it was best to let people turn up whenever they wished. Igor's manner with patients was somewhat brusque, although at times he seemed capable of sympathy. Since I do not speak Russian or Ukrainian, I could only guess at what was being said before it was translated by Igor, and I discovered that often I was entirely wrong. The patients brought their own brain scans, arranged previously, and without further ado, I would be asked whether surgery was possible or not. In English medicine, it is drilled into one at a very early stage that one should base one's decisions on taking a history and examining the patient, and that only at the end should one look at the special investigations, such as X-rays and brain scans. Here, the whole process was reversed and compressed into a few minutes or even seconds. I felt like the Emperor Nero at the Roman Games. It was made all the more difficult by the fact that the brain scans were usually of poor quality. It was difficult to see clearly what was going on, and this made me even more uneasy about having to make so many rapid life-or-death decisions. On this